You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Is there a chemical or a neurological switch that regulates compassion in human behavior? Paul Dzak, professor of economics, management, and psychology at Claremont Graduate University, thinks he's found it in oxytocin. The presence or absence of that chemical may explain how humans are capable of both stunning self-sacrifice and diabolical cruelty. Professor Zach's new book, The Moral Molecule, The Source of Love and Prosperity, is published by Dutton. We learned a lot of surprising information when Paul Dzak was on our show in March, so we have decided to air that interview again. I began by asking him, weren't you the victim of a rather elaborate con when you were a teenager working at an Argo gas station?
I was, actually, a very classic con called a pigeon drop. And having been conned, started me thinking about, look at the range of human behaviors, right? I was a kid, I didn't know much, thought people were mostly good, and I got, you know, taken for $100. How's that happen?
It's unlikely that the man who conned you knew about oxytocin and its effects, but do you think that he understood the way oxytocin would lead you to make that mistake?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he really played on that system of trust.
What happened, actually?
This guy came up and said, I found this beautiful jewelry case with a pearl necklace inside of it in the bathroom. Guy calls up in the office almost right after that. Oh, well, give a $200 reward. Lost my wife's jewelry. And so, you know, this is a con called the pigeon drop. So they played me. And, of course, I took the money out of the cash drawer. I don't have $100. I'm 18 years old.
So you're splitting the difference with him.
Exactly right. And so it plays on the sense of me wanting to help him. How do I help this man get his jewelry to his wife?
But there was greed also involved, wasn't
it? Absolutely. So these can run together. So one of the punchlines from the book is the reason that we are mostly moral creatures, most of us most of the time, is because it feels good. It sustains us as social creatures in our social groups.
Do you think that experience influenced the path your research would take later?
No question about it. That and I had a sort of funny upbringing. My mother, before she was my mother, was a nun. And so this sense of appropriate moral behavior is really sitting in the house all the time. And even though I kind of rejected this top-down view of morality, I wondered if there was kind of a bottom-up, was there a biological basis for why people are good or evil.
You begin the book with a description of what you call the vampire wedding, a wedding at which you were doing an experiment. What was your protocol?
Right. With permission, I went to a wedding in which I knew not a single person.
This has to be an odd wedding.
It was a beautiful wedding, actually, a beautiful country mansion in Devon, which is out in the country. And I took blood from the bride and the groom and the wedding party and the family and the friends before, immediately after the vows. And the question was, why would you spend $50,000 to $100,000 on a wedding? That's a down payment on a house, except for in New York. So what we showed was that not only do weddings induce the release of oxytocin in people who attend, but they do so in a particular gradated way. So who is the center of the wedding solar system? The bride, of course. Biggest increase in oxytocin. She's feeling this connection to people around her. Who loves the wedding almost as much as the bride? Her mother. Mm-hmm. She was number two. Then the family, then the friends. And so oxytocin is not a sledgehammer. It's a subtle on-off switch that says, oh, here's Leonard. He's safe. I should connect to him. And here's Bob. He's not safe. I should be wary.
So is compassion or lack of it merely the result of chemical reaction?
Well, merely is a throwaway line. Evolution.
Well,
is
you know,
most
we do believe in free will. Many people believe in free will.
Oh, think of the way the brain evolved. It's just like a miracle this all works. So what we found is that when people release oxytocin, they report the experience of empathy. They feel connected to people around them, and subsequently, they're more generous, compassionate, kind, trustworthy.
Why did the groom's father increase the oxytocin in the groom's father increase more than in the groom?
Right. So there's all these interesting feedbacks. So why do we have good and evil if we have a moral molecule? That's kind of the key point. And because it interacts, you know, our brain lives in this soup of chemicals with other chemicals. And the groom in particular had a doubling of his levels of testosterone, which is a potent oxytocin inhibitor. Why did his testosterone go up and no other man in the group did? Ah, he's got this beautiful woman. She's in a strapless gown. She's the center of attention. He's thinking about the honeymoon.
Mm-hmm. So we'll get back to testosterone in a little bit, but let's talk a bit about oxytocin. When was it first discovered?
So it was discovered about 50 years ago. The Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1953 was given for a synthesis, and about 10,000 women a day in North America get this synthetic version of oxytocin called Pitocin to speed up birth. So we know a lot about this drug, but it was only thought to be an OBGYN chemical until about 10 years ago, when I was focused on why you would trust a stranger. And I was focused on this because I had shown in cross-country work that trust was among the strongest predictors of which countries would be rich or poor economists had ever found.
And yet, how you got started, looking at why some countries succeed and some didn't.
Exactly right.
And then you wound up with this whole other thing.
And trust was this kind of big factor. And so I was able to characterize environments which trust is high or low. But inevitably, people would ask me, well, for a given environment, why would two strangers ever trust each other? And then you get which I call the weenie effect. I'm a big weenie if I can't answer the simplest question in the world, which is, gee, why does that occur? That seems like the most basic question. Turned to be a very hard question to answer because oxytocin is a shy molecule. You have to coax the brain to release it, and when it's released, it has a very short half-life. So it required me retooling my whole research program to take blood, process it, deal with dry ice in freezers and centrifuges, and I figured out how to do that.
Well, so you developed this thing you call a trust game, which I doubt any other economist would have come up with.
Not true, actually. I stole that from a Nobel Prize winner named Vernon Smith. And people in this trust game, you can exchange money with other people in the lab, but anonymously. And if you exchange money, it grows in size, but the other person controls it. So they may or may not reciprocate your trust. And economists were flummoxed on why you would ever reciprocate trust in an anonymous one-shot setting. But what we showed was that the more money someone sends you denoting trust, the more your brain releases oxytocin, and the more oxytocin on board, the more you reciprocate. So we have a biology of reciprocation. So economists were like, oh, what does this mean? Why isn't everybody taking all the money? But we know as human beings, again, as good social creatures, we've got to play nice when you play nice.
Well, most economists don't draw blood. But can you explain the rules to the trust game a little better?
Sure. So we recruit participants for an experiment. They all get $10 for showing up. And then with lots of instruction and without any deception, because we're the good behavior guys, it would be bad karma if we deceived people in an experiment. We match people in pairs randomly, and within each pair, there's a first decision maker and a second decision maker. And again, after lots of instruction, the first decision maker gets a prompt by computer saying, would you like to give up some of your $10 that you earned for being here and ship it to the other person in the lab who you can't see or talk to, and you'll do it one time? Whatever you give up comes out of your account, but is tripled in the other person's account. And the other person gets a prompt by computer saying, guy one sent you, whatever, $24, so you have $34 in your account. Would you like to send some amount back to him or her? We never use the word trust or trustworthiness. And people readily do this. We find that 90% of first decision makers will send money, and 95% of the people who return money, who get money, will return some of it.
But it's a game. Would it be work the same way if we were then putting it into real life situations? I'm not so sure.
Right. It sort of captures that, you know, why would you ever interact nicely with a stranger? But after 10 years in the lab, I did, again, it's like the weenie test, right? So if I really can't show this works outside the world, outside the laboratory, I mean, you know, then how can I say it generalizes? So we've gone to weddings. We've gone to churches. I jumped out of an airplane and took my blood before and after, strapped myself to another guy. I'm afraid of heights, so this is a big deal for me. So, you know, if I'm really going to risk my life by strapping myself to some guy and jumping out of an airplane at 12,000 feet, what happens in my brain?
My guest is Paul J. Zak, Z-A-K. His book, The Moral Molecule, The Source of Love and Prosperity. It's also the name of his blog, which is out of Psychology Today.
Psychology Today, correct.
Does life experience alter the way the oxytocin works in the body?
It does. So again, this field is so new. When I started doing this work about 10 years ago, one of my colleagues said, this is the world's stupidest idea. We know it's only for women. It can't be that important. I said, no, men's brains make this too.
Wait, so it was about women that made it stupid?
That's what I think with this implication. This guy was an OBGYN, so, you know, not the guy you want delivering your baby. So men's brains make this too. Having said that, Leonard, I should tell you, every experiment we've run, women's brains release more than men and are subsequently nicer.
So. But you say testosterone counterbalances oxytocin. Women have testosterone
in
their systems as well.
Men have about 10 times as much as women. So in experiments where we administer testosterone to men, we make them more selfish and more entitled.
Now, is it possible for someone to consciously control the level of oxytocin in their blood at any given time? Or is this just a physiological reaction to stimuli?
Right. This is a really ancient molecule. It lives in evolutionarily old areas of the brain. And it's like love. It's the basis for love. You can't force someone to love you. You can only give it away. So you can cause someone else's brain to release oxytocin. So should we tell them our secret? When I walked in the studio, I hugged you because we've showed that touch releases oxytocin. So does
but you didn't draw
things.
Blood, so we don't know whether my oxytocin levels went up.
Your face lit up. I think that works. So other things, praying, meditation, exercising as a group, singing, many ways to raise oxytocin. And then you have this about a half-hour glow in which you feel more connected, you feel more empathic, and in fact feel happier.
So the reason that the conventional wisdom is that women are more compassionate than men is based on oxytocin levels?
It appears to be. And you asked this question about nurturing. And so
does Michelle Bachman know about this?
Let's take some blood from her. So this nurturing is very important, and women historically do more nurturing than men do. But I think in the modern world, men, it's very important to connect to your children and get that oxytocin release and build those relationships.
So you test testosterone levels as well as oxytocin levels when you're doing the trust game?
That's right. And we've shown, in fact, that men with high testosterone are more likely to spend their resources to punish people who don't play nice. So we have this nice trade-off in our bodies now. We have oxytocin that connects us to others, and we tend to treat others we're connected to nicely. But we also have testosterone, primarily males, but not only, that makes us want to punish people who behave badly. So I say, we don't really need God or government telling us what to do because it's all inside our bodies.
In fact, you try to get people who like to inflict punishment in your trust game.
We do, and these are these high testosterone
males. We're not talking about sadists, are we?
We're not. We're just talking about generally young men who want to really enforce the rules and will spend their resources doing it. They'll spend their own money to punish people who don't play nice. And again, that's that trade-off. So maybe I don't feel connected to you, but my experience is if I don't play nice with you, I play bad with you, you play bad with me, that's another way to sustain morality among the social creatures.
What did the experiment done at the University of Erfurt in Germany tell you about the use of punishers in a society?
Yeah, that punishment is an effective way to sustain cooperation. So again, there's this yin and yang factor. So in this experiment in Germany, which I wasn't involved in, there were exchange of money tasks in which you could join a group that punished people who took the money and tried to run away, or you can go in a group that was kind of a free-loving hippie commune. And hippie commune, you know, what happens is everyone ends up going in for their own self and doesn't help the group as a goal. So, you know, punishment is important. And what we've shown is that punishment is driven by testosterone and primarily driven by men.
But then that would suggest that punishing children is a good idea. We've been moving in the opposite direction, haven't we?
Well, setting boundaries. So I'll give you an example of one practical advice in the book, which is the timeout. So the timeout says, you're a little child, and you're behaving badly, so we don't want to be around you. So I invented the time in. So I have little kids. When my kids are freaked out, not having fun, they sit in my lap for 5 minutes and make eye contact and get held. So that says, you're having a bad time. You need more love. You need more attention. I'm going to calm you down. So punishment also important. We need to set boundaries. And this doesn't mean people aren't accountable for what they do. Oh, my high testosterone made me do it. No, you still have a frontal cortex where you can make decisions.
And recently I've been seeing ads on cable television suggesting that men have lower levels of testosterone as they age, and they should buy these pills.
That's right. And so these are exactly the pills
we use in experiments. The anti-oxytocin pills.
Well, see, you know, nature's so beautiful. So when you're in a committed relationship, your testosterone falls. When you have children, your testosterone falls. And I don't have evidence for this other than myself, but when you have girl children like me, your testosterone goes to zero. You're a big girly man.
Tom from Seabrook, New Jersey, has written in to ask, do you think that kindness and altruism is rooted in the thought that you'll get something in return? I guess that's the Ayn Rand approach to this story.
So sometimes it is, and yet in settings in which people are completely anonymous, in laboratory control settings, we still see lots of compassionate, kind care. This is like travel, right? I travel a lot like you do, and people regularly in the airport will hold the door for me, will help me get a cab, give me directions in New York. Are they getting any benefit from that? No, they're burning their time and resources. It's a beautiful thing.
My guest is Paul Jaczak. His book, The Moral Molecule, A Source of Love and Prosperity, published by Dutton. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Paul Jaczak, who's a professor of economics, management, and psychology at Claremont Graduate University and the founding director of Claremont's Center for Neuroeconomic Studies. His book, The Moral Molecule, The Source of Love and Prosperity, published by Dutton. Are you the creator of
economics. I think the field, you know, the idea was floating around. I'm the first person who published the word, apparently. So I get the, you know, in the Oxford English Dictionary, I get the check mark.
And you talked earlier about beginning your career building models of what makes countries prosper. What kinds of factors did you study, and what is the link between that and what we're talking about now?
Great question. So trust is a great indicator of things going well in a country. So when trust is high, we showed the social sector works, the political sector works, and the economic sector works effectively. So it's kind of a summary measure. So the highest trust country in the world is Norway. There's also an underlying biological factor. So what do you know about Norway? Equal distribution of income. There's like four last names. Everyone's connected to each other. And so it's a very easy way to trust other people versus a country like Colombia, which is the lowest trust country in the world. Highly heterogeneous distribution of income, different ethnic groups, unstable governments, although getting better now. So trust is a kind of a lubricant for economic transactions.
Well, that means we're in trouble right now, because this country, it seems to me, trust levels have gone down considerably. That's what we see in the political debate. People are saying, you know, I don't trust the other side.
Right. So trust has actually fallen in the United States since the late 60s. Around 1968, it was about 60% of Americans said they trusted others. Now it's around 35%.
Wow.
Yeah, very low. So,
we didn't lock our doors as much in those days either.
That's right. So when trust is high, then not only do you not have to lock your doors, but it's easy to undertake economic transactions that are wealth improving, that can help increase prosperity, because we can do it on a handshake. We don't need three lawyers, two judges, and a bailiff to tell us what to do. So transaction costs are lower, and so therefore more transactions occur. What's interesting, Leonard, is also in these high trust countries, they are happier. So if we want to live in a happy society, we can use the knowledge in this book to create those kind of organizations that connect us to others, lead to more morality, and more prosperity.
Although in Norway, there was this terrible tragedy last year, so you can't trust everybody, even in a trust society.
Of course. And so we talked
about... Somebody could always come into a camp and start shooting up killing all the kids.
That's right. And again, where's that kind of evil psychopathology come from? Some of that is genetic. Some is children who are abused or abandoned. The system we've shown in experiments doesn't develop properly without enough nurturing. So even though we do, as you said earlier, have to punish children to tell them what the bright lines are, we still need to nurture them enough so the system develops for empathy and care.
Now, in the 18th century, both Adam Smith in The Theory of Moral Sentiment and David Hume in A Treatise on Human Nature were thinking about these sorts of things, weren't they? Of course, they didn't know about oxytocin and testosterone.
That's right. So I haven't been to a church in 25 years, but I'm a born-again Smithian. I think Adam Smith nailed this. So in this 1759 book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, he developed the first biological basis for morality. And I didn't know about this until I finished much of my work, but he anticipated almost all of it. So he said, we tend not to hurt other people as social creatures, because if we have empathy, which is a word we have now that he didn't have, then we would feel their pain, so we avoid that. And if we do something that brings other people joy, then we get to share in that joy. So what I found was the underlying molecule behind this. Now, this is valuable because the neuroscience tells us how to tune up or tune down this oxytocin response. And so it gives us much sharper predictions than Adam Smith had, but Smith had a lot of this already.
We have a caller who is a molecular imagist. Well, we did have a caller who was. George, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to say I'm a molecular imaging specialist and have experience with brain scans and such as that, and as well as philosophy of science. So I hear your guest loud and clear. But I think what is being associated here is corollary and not causality. So many of the things that your guest is asserting, you have oxytocin levels doing this and that, but you really don't have causality. It's very hard to prove causality, but I think that's necessary before you make these broad leaps about society and philosophy. I mean, these are dramatic leaps.
Great question, George. Thanks for setting that one up for me. So we thought a lot about this when we first started doing the experiment. So the second experiment we did was exactly on causality, and we replicated this many times. We developed an FDA-approved way to administer testosterone directly to the human brain safely, and I put more people on synthetic oxytocin intranasally than anybody in the United States. hundreds and hundreds of people, and we can turn on and turn off moral behavior like a garden hose. So even though people are cognitively intact, once you connect them to others, either through an external stimulus or pharmacologically, all of a sudden people are connecting and caring about people around them.
And you said oxytocin is something that we find throughout the animal kingdom, going all the way back to the most primitive creatures?
That's right. Traced its history at least 400 million years back to fish, and it modulated approach withdrawal behaviors.
So, is that why they go? They swim in schools?
Swim in schools, but also approach for things like fertilization, so facilitates reproduction. But in human beings, this system is in hyperdrive. So we not only care about our family, our friends, our kids, we go crazy for pets. We name our cars. I mean, we attach to all kinds of things. And so this system has allowed us to go from living in small kin-based groups to actually living in New York City. We're around a sea of strangers all the time. And we have to have something in our heads that says, this person okay, this person not. Otherwise, we don't have civilization. We don't have specialization of labor, prosperity. So it really does form the basis for civilization.
What did Sue Carter's work on two different species of voles say about oxytocin?
Sue was a great mentor early on when I started doing this work, and she found two species of voles in the Midwest, one of whom the males are promiscuous and one is monogamous. So monogamous means group living, and these monogamous mammals, voles, had oxytocin receptors just like human beings, a big group in the frontal cortex that makes it feel good to do good. And so this work motivated my own study in human beings to ask, why do we regularly do things that are nice for people when no one's looking?
A listener called in to ask about, I don't know if you saw it, the New York Times article in the magazine this weekend about kids are now being diagnosed, children, as psychopaths. And I wonder whether oxytocin is something that we should be looking for in these stories.
So it's very interesting. So I'm technically an economist, although I work in behavioral neuroscience. And this work has spawned a variety of clinical trials, some of which I'm involved in, some of which I'm not, including autism, schizophrenia, many other fields. So oxytocin replacement may actually work, but for psychopaths, not so much. We found that about 5% of our population don't release oxytocin stimulus. They look a lot like psychopaths. They're deceptive. They're self-deceptive. They don't attach well to individuals. They're mildly depressed. They're kind of charming. They like taking advantage of people. And so they don't have
the Bernie Madoff would have low levels of oxytocin?
Yeah, they just don't have the receptors for this for whatever reason. It could be born that way. It could be bred. And unfortunately, just replacing the chemical doesn't work. It has minor effects, by the way, for people in autism, but it's not a cure. It's not a cure for shyness. But it does help us connect.
We did get a number of questions from listeners about autism and mirror neurons, which have also been related to autistic kids having fewer mirror neurons. I don't know. Is there any link between oxytocin and mirror neurons?
There might be. We're still exploring that. I think what's nice about oxytocin is, you know, chemicals in the brain are both measurable and manipulable. So we can get exactly as George the caller said, direct causation of what causes what. Mirror neurons are part of a much larger brain system. We have found in our imaging work that oxytocin does release two other chemicals, dopamine and serotonin. So when we connect, when we feel empathic towards others, we not only get a reward response in the brain, we get this mood lift as well. So the system is really set up to keep us embedded in our social group.
My guest is Paul J. Zak. His book, The Moral Molecule, The Source of Love and Prosperity, published by Dutton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Another listener is asking about video games. Do violent video games increase levels of testosterone and therefore counteract the effects of oxytocin?
They certainly increase levels of stress hormones. I haven't seen work done on testosterone. And it turns out that stress is also, high stress, is a potent inhibitor of oxytocin. Although the relationship is kind of an inverted U, which is interesting. So if you've been in a turbulent airplane and you don't want to talk to the person next to you, all of a sudden now you start talking to them. So moderate stress helps us connect to others, but high stress shuts it down. So yeah, I don't think video games that are violent are a good idea.
What did the Whitehall study reveal about the worst kind of job a person could have?
Yeah, this is a study of British civil servants, a long-running longitudinal study, and these kind of jobs where you're not in control of your life, where you don't have a lot of choices, leads to high levels of things like stress, depression, kind of lack of control of your life is bad for human beings. And so I think part of this work talks about empowering individuals around us to make their own mistakes, to do really well. recognize that people are going to be imperfect, and we ourselves are imperfect, but still love them, still give them support.
Aren't there people who have a problem of too much trust?
There are.
It's even a disease, isn't there?
Right. So there is a pathological altruism, and we've studied some individuals with rare brain disorders in which they can't modulate trust and distrust. So think of the edges of the distribution. If you're a social creature and you're gullible, you'll be a target for bad people. But if you're paranoid, everyone's out to get you, that's also not adaptive. So oxytocin is like a gyroscope, helps us maintain this balance of when it's appropriate to be trusting, when it's not. And it does this by having this very short half-life, 3 minutes. So I turn it on, then I turn it off right away. So I'm constantly modulating my behavior. So what we found in the lab is dozens of ways that we can stimulate the brain to release oxytocin and, again, give us this half an hour kind of glow period where people feel happy, connected, calm, and actually even improve their immune system.
And what happens when you're hearing something that sounds appealing and then suddenly a warning light goes off in your brain?
Oh, yeah. These fear mechanisms happen, you know, within milliseconds. So oxytocin releases shut down, and all of a sudden you're in, you know, survival mode.
Well, you know, you're hearing something that says, wait a minute, this is not as good as it sounds.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And then the minute you shut down, you are in a whole other state. Then nothing often can get you back.
Then you have to reboot this. So we do find about 20% of the people, again, of hundreds and hundreds that put in synthetic oxytocin, don't have an effect. So we still have a prefrontal cortex, which we call the executive area of the brain. We can decide what we want to do and not do. These are just these ancient body signals. Actually, you have oxytocin receptors in your heart and your vagus nerve and your gut that tells you, does this feel right or not? It doesn't have to be a perfect system. It just has to be a good enough system.
You describe another personal experience in the book, an almost religious experience of music you heard on the radio in your car. What happened?
That's right, an NPR station.
Of course.
As I said, I'm sort of agnostic on religion. I think there's many good aspects to
your
it.
Your mother almost became a nun and you're agnostic.
She was a nun. Oh. Well, you know, I was an altar boy at Latin Mass, second of incense for 7 years. So, yeah, you know, I'm not sure about the top-down system. Why do only Catholics go to heaven? Doesn't make any sense to me. So, but from a bottom-up perspective, I did have this religious experience in which I felt this wave of empathy. I started crying. I just felt connected to the entire world. And we've shown that this same kind of experience can happen during intense rituals. So even though I try to avoid asking about religion in my studies, I finally had to go into churches and actually have these religious experiences with people and see how powerful they are.
Because they just suck you in. And Bach, listening to something by Bach doesn't hurt either.
Absolutely.
I suspect I always get oxytocin every time I listen to something by Bach.
Absolutely. And even doing this, I went just about 8 months ago to the highlands of Papua New Guinea and ran an experiment with indigenous people there who are subsistence farmers living in a rainforest and had them do a typical ritual they do that they've done for thousands of years. And not only did this ritual cause oxytocin release in these participants, but I also felt amazingly close to this little village of 1,000 people who let me come into their houses and their sacred huts. So we've really taken this work all around the world.
Did you invent the product Liquid Trust?
This is a funny story. So about 3 months after we published our first oxytocin inhaler study in 2005, there was a lot of media. It was in New York and all the morning shows. And 3 months later, this product came on the internet called Liquid Trust, which claims to be oxytocin. It's very expensive, by the way. Cited all my research in media. But it cannot have any oxytocin in it because that's a prescription drug. And I should say for listeners that oxytocin intranasally is only approved now for research protocols. It's not generally available, and certainly don't buy Liquid Trust. It's not real.
And you said that in some cases it works with autistic people. I'm assuming Asperger's as well. But it hasn't proven to be completely successful?
It hasn't. So just because your body may not be producing a lot of this, for example, in autism, doesn't mean replacing it is going to solve that problem because entire brain circuits are dysregulated. So there were a number of clinical trials right here in New York at Mount Sinai, and again, small effects. What's interesting is those who had the most severe symptoms were helped the most by oxytocin, but still the help was marginal.
Stephen Levitt and Stephen Dubner of Freakonomics say that morality represents the way we would like the world to work. Economics represents how it actually does work. Do you agree with them?
Not at all. So, you know, we cannot be self-interested or selfish creatures and be sustained in our social group. It doesn't work in economics. It doesn't work in human society. It doesn't work in relationships. And so I think getting to the biology and really grounding economics in human biology is the way to get us out of building models of crazy things that you know, autonomous agents might do. I don't know what that is. I'm interested in people, and so I want to study human beings making decisions that involve money, not money, other people. That's what's interesting.
Well, you said that trust is important in economic development. The United States is the most economically advanced country in the world, and yet you say that our trust level is around 30%. So are we just limping along?
At some level, we are. We get by with having very good government institutions that help enforce contracts, formal and informal, right? So if someone cheats me in an economic transaction, I have lots of ways I can get recompense. At the same time, I can feel pretty confident that I can write a very short contract, shake hands, and get to work. So if we could raise our trust levels, the amount of payoff in terms of more prosperity and greater happiness is substantial, and we should do that.
And if a politician seems to be proposing legislation that gets rid of all that regulation and all those things that supposedly allow us to trust each other, should we assume that person has low oxytocin levels?
Or maybe they just haven't read the book.
And the book is The Moral Molecule, The Source of Love and Prosperity. It's published by Dutton. My great thanks to Paul J. Zak for coming by to talk about it.
Thanks for having me on. What a thrill.